Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, I'll be chatting with Luciana Bond. Luciana is a professor at Edinburgh College. She is an all-around wise woman and fountain of knowledge. And we'll be talking about the October Socialist Revolution, and we'll be talking about how that transformed to the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and why understanding it is so important for today in the new climate of Russophobia and neo-McCarthyism. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back with Luciana Bond. Luciana Bond, welcome to Cindy's Soapbox.
Pleasure to be here, and thanks for asking, Cindy.
Well, one of the best things about having my own podcast is that I get to interview people who fascinate me and who interest me, and to give people their own soapbox to who have views contrary to the established propaganda, the corporate media, etc. So, Luciana, talk a little bit about yourself and your background for my listeners.
Be glad to, except that it's a long and complicated story.
Well, that's okay.
I am, I am 77 years old. Therefore, my life covers World War II, first 5 years. Mm-hmm. 3 years of socialist Yugoslavia, then, let's see, about 8 years of education, or 10 in Italy, immigration to the United States, and those are the stages of my life events. The war has impressed the first 5 years of my life, the Second World War, has clearly been the greatest impact. Now, it's complicated, but I was in what was then Italian territory in the northeast of Italy, near Trieste. And the first 3 years are, of course, I can't remember anything. But the last 2 years, 2 years under Nazi occupation, I was obviously very alert to the dangers of occupation, the abuses, the burning of villages, the resistance, all those things. And then there are certain very strong images that have remained in my psyche, and probably the most influential is August 6th, 1945, when I was 5 and a half.
Right.
And that was Hiroshima. Now, my life was lived in a very rural place, a village of no more than 300 inhabitants, and I grew up without radio except seeing the adults listening to London radio, etc. But you know, no telephone, no TV, no papers during the war. So what I heard, and I've written about this on shortly after August 6th, next day or It was just an encounter between one of my uncles and a local farmer, and I wasn't paying attention. They were talking until I heard the farmer saying, yes, a big bomb. Somewhere in Japan, the Americans. Now, of course, the Americans had been the great, everybody was waiting for the Allied forces to rid us of the Nazis.
Right.
So in my tiny head, they were some kind of champions. And to hear that they had dropped this big bomb and that it would be the end of the world, quoting the farmer, I just froze and realized that the war would continue or something like that. And that is probably the genesis of my obsession, if you like, with war situations. Now, the 3 years in socialist Yugoslavia, that is, in the liberated by the partisans, by Tito's partisan areas, straight south of Trieste, those 3 years were... I hardly remember anything except that as a child I liked the partisans, etc. But the evil here, which I consider an evil, was anti-Soviet propaganda, which was promulgated by the former fascist occupiers, the Italians. So this region, this tiny region in which I was 5 to 8 years old, was still contested. Would it go to Italy or would it go to Yugoslavia? So we were in limbo. So the propaganda that was issuing from Allied occupied Italy was fiercely anti-communist. There were even some false flag events. So my father, who was anti-communist, in a ordinary way, not a fascist, and he himself had been ruined by education during the 20 years occupation by the fascists here in this tiny place called Istria. He had been in Libya. He had been under terrible situations. But nevertheless, he had a kind of petty bourgeois, well-off peasant class. But I would say petty bourgeois because they were also dealing in trade and wine and et cetera. So let's call it petty bourgeois, typical of the peasant class. The peasant class that wants to be middle class. I hope I'm making myself clear. And he decided to leave. Now, in 1947, we were given, people in my place, were given the option of voting for staying or leaving. In other words, leaving legally rather than as many people were doing. This is Eastern Europe, more or less. Leaving. So at that point, in 1948, we came to Italy, where I was continuing my education, first started in the Slavic languages and now Italian. One of the first images I saw in Italy, and I think this is another vivid image that formed me, one of the first photographs that I saw on Italian newspapers was pictures of tents in the desert. This was May 1948, late May. And these tents in the deserts were those of Palestinians who had been evicted from their villages, haunted by the newly formed Israeli state. Now, I didn't know anything about that, but, you know, I grew up in the Nazi terror, an anti-communist atmosphere, climate at home, which later I began to question, in a kind of 3 years of, well, the first 2 years of elementary school were in Croatian, were in Serbo-Croatian, and it was peaceful, it was nice, and then was thrown into Italian culture at home. We spoke many dialects. Italian dialect, Serbo-Croatian dialect, I heard all sorts of them. There wasn't even an official, I don't even know what my native tongue is,
wow.
Cindy. You know, that's why when people tell me, what are you? I just, whoa, I'm trying to find out. So once in Italy, I became very attached to Italian culture, Italian way. Things were going well until my parents decided to come to America because my father thought there would be another war and the Soviets would win. Off we go to America. There, I go to college because, to be fair to my parents, that was their first priority, to educate me. You see there where the petty bourgeois ideology actually worked for me?
Yeah.
I had to improve myself. And really, I was the only immigrant child whose parents didn't send to work. Not send, you know, to help with the whole family situation. So they went through tremendous sacrifices, and I ended up at New York University, where I became I came under the influence of the 60s and American friends who were telling me and debunking the myth of America. It's really strange, Cindy. It's really strange how I came to consciousness. It took decades, but the years in university in the upper of the 60s made me question things. My parents' version of not my parents, my mother, poor thing, was sweet. And, you know, my father's anti-communism, had we really fled from the Red Horror? Was it a horror? Why, you know, there were 25,000 people in the United States that had the same exodus as we did, and all believed that. No, I'm incorrect. I was going to say that all believed that they were fleeing, you know, the Red Menace, but no, I think that some of them were just devastated by the war, had relatives in the United States from the 30s, etc. But nevertheless, the Vietnam War happened, and there were heated discussions between me and my father about it, as you can imagine. And then I went on from there. Is that more or less good as a framework?
I think it's absolutely fascinating and wonderful. And so I was telling you before we started recording that I was in New York City over the 4th of July weekend, and there I was attending a conference about the Great October Socialist Revolution in the 100th anniversary in Russia in 1917. And one of your Facebook pictures is a tribute to 1917, and how so pitifully misunderstood it is in the United States. And I'm a child of the Cold War. I was born in 1957, right in the middle of it. You know, I was I went through my college years, you know, with a heavy emphasis. I majored in U.S. history. Not till I was in my last year of college did I learn any alternative history to the standard. You know, it was all, it's all about wars and presidents and and white people
battles,
and victory and stuff like that. And so the more I learn about the October Socialist Revolution, the more I learn about the Soviet Union, the more I learn about Lenin and Stalin, the more I know that I don't know very much. And that, and everything that I was taught up until today was practically just a bald-faced lie. I mean, just take your experience in World War II. The Soviet Union actually defeated the Nazis, and the United States wants to take that as its victory. So what's your perspective on the Great October Socialist Revolution, the victories of the Soviet Union, and the bread, what was the theme was peace, bread, and land.
Yes, of the socialist, of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, yes. And, well, to focus myself, I will just, I mean, I have to do the same debunking of my education, both you know, the education that I got at home regarding communism and the kind of education I got at university, just like you. I had to debunk that afterwards. Luckily, coming from outside, I could feel that something was not right in what they were telling me. But anyway, about 1917, I mean, all I need to point, I mean, what I need to point out, what I want to point out to start with, that the Bolshevik Revolution happened, let's stick to the calendar then, on the 25th of April. I mean, of October, 25th of October, 1917. On the 26th of October, the revolutionary government issued two decrees. One is peace. Oops, now I'm going to forget the second. Oh, the third. Hold on a second. Oh, yes. The first decree was peace, with no indemnities. The second was land redistribution, taking effect immediately. Land to the peasants, which constituted 80% of the Russian people.
Right.
The third decree, just a little bit later, I don't know, 48 hours, I don't remember, was a decree that granted autonomy, independence, equality, and secession, if they preferred it, to what the Bolsheviks called the national people, meaning what we would say national minorities of the Russian Empire. So with these three decrees, the first three decrees, leaving out what came after, the equality of women, the right to vote, divorce, etc. I mean, the first three decrees established the concept of no war, land, equitably redistributed, and equality to so-called minorities. So this, you know, this is revolutionary.
Right.
Yeah, So, what else? Would you like to focus me with a question from there?
Okay. And we have to remember at that time that World War One was devastating Russia, and the Tsar's participation in it was disastrous for the people.
Exactly, yes. As a matter of fact, Imperial Russia, the Tsar, was very reluctant to join World War One, but they had 9 million men at arms, potentially, without shoes, without good equipment, without training. So England did everything possible to lure the Imperial Army into the war, promising things that Russia coveted, the exit to the Mediterranean, through the Black Sea, etc. But it was a disaster for the Russian soldiers, for the Russian armies. And it was Lenin in 1914 who was shocked. Well, okay, let me back up a minute. So the war broke out in 1914, and what is tragic about it is that all the social democrats, then a large party throughout Europe, voted for war credits, you know, voted in parliament. They were in parliament, the Social Democrat Party, and Germany had the largest one. And they voted in parliament to join their nation, their country, their state in the war. Well, you know, this is like saying proletarians of the war, of the world, kill each other. And Lenin was absolutely shocked. He was still in exile in Switzerland, and wondered, what the hell did we do that we came into this error? Yeah, go ahead.
As a matter of fact, I'm not, you know, I'm not really like educated on the Communist Internationals, but didn't Lenin have a break with one of the Comintern's around that time also?
Well, the...
Or was it just the German parliament?
He went into a sort of... I don't know what his official move was, do you?
Mm-mm.
No.
That's okay, we can just move on.
He opposed the war. He was called a defeatist by all his by the followers before, and that's all I remember of that. Well, perhaps I'm not focusing really, but go ahead.
No, that's okay. And so I can't believe we've already been talking for so long. I'm totally fascinated by this conversation, but I think it's really important to talk about these things, Luciana, because of the Russophobia that's happening right now. That people want to, it seems like the liberals in this country want to lead us into a new Cold War or hot war just because their candidate Hillary Clinton lost. So I think it's so important to not only tell the truth about what's happening in Russia today, which, you know, there's much to oppose, especially if we're revolutionary socialists ourselves. There's much to oppose, but not the so-called hacking of the elections or whatever. But so I think it's important to understand our history with the U.S. history with the Soviet Union. And you posted something about the new Wonder Woman movie. She might be fighting the Soviet Union in the next movie. And I think it's not frivolous. I don't think it's frivolous. I think when the United States had all this Islamophobia, there were many Hollywood movies like Zero Dark Thirty and, mm-hmm. you know, and such movies to exploit, you know, almost written by the CIA. So talk a little bit about, I can't believe our time is running out, but talk a little bit about the significance of that.
Our time is running out. I never asked you how long.
I know. We have about 5 minutes left. I can't believe it. It's been, to me, such a fascinating conversation.
Oh, that's incredible, Cindy. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
I know. It's
been okay,
amazing.
But let's start at the point of this now. We have 5 minutes. Russophobia. Well, why is it generated? Why, you know, as you pointed out in the cultural propaganda like Hollywood, why? Well, I think it's because in the last 7 years, Russia has refused to become the kind of colony that it was in the Yeltsin years. That is, open veins, take whatever you like. Privatize, loot to the West, open veins to the West. So Putin said, no more. I mean, he has started whatever he can of retaking and renationalizing some of the petroleum and gas industries. In other words, Russia said, let's call it, you know, abstractly, Russia said, no more penetration either. And it's neo-capitalist, there's no question, but it has a strong streak of nationalist self-survival, of sort of, you know, self-protective. So what can you do then? If you're in the United States, what can you do to fight this withdrawal from the imperialist goals of the West? Well, you can demonize it, you can sanction it, you can isolate it, which they haven't succeeded. So the Russophobia is, of course, the propaganda that's controlling people's mind, that's trying to control people's mind toward a policy of, I would call it, colonialism toward what the former Soviet Union. I mean, first, the Soviet Union was fragmented deliberately with people who worked, with Western interests and their own interests, people meaning a class, petty bourgeois. Oh, and so the Soviet Union was fragmented. And the next step was to fragment Russia, because you can, like, look at East Europe. It's all little statelets. And so they're furious in Washington that Russia has slipped out of their hands as a full-time colony. I mean, I don't hesitate to call the goals of the United States that were to colonize the former Soviet Union and especially Russia. But we haven't even touched the tip of the problem, Cindy.
Well, what do you think? Because, you know, this is a podcast. I don't have any set time. We could go longer if we want. What is the tip of the problem?
Oh, the disintegration of the Soviet Union.
And?
That's a big one. And the expectations that followed after it, from the point of view of the West. Yes.
What about the... Okay, the elephant in the room to many people who have been educated in the United States is Stalin. It's like the evil Stalin. I'm reading a book right now that I'm slogging through because it's online and there's many, many mistakes. I'm waiting for the hard copy. It's called Khrushchev Lied by Grover Fur.
And, that's right.
You know, I think... to me, with my small level of understanding, the people who started the anti-Stalin propaganda were actually members of his own party.
Yes. Well, you see, that's another deception to consider the Communist Party of Russia, of the Soviet Union and Russia before that, a monolithic party. In fact, it had wings, right wings and left wings. I don't know if there was a center, but at least it had those. So there were fierce discussions within, from the get-go, within the Communist Party, how to build socialism, what is the best way. There was the Trotsky way, there was the Stalin way, eventually, and the Bukharin way. Those three were parties within the Communist Party. Now, where else did I want to go? So, the Black Legend. I mean, most people who read Gruver say, well, that's only, you know, one voice. But no, I just read an Italian book called The Black Legend by a philosophy professor, Marxist analyst, but not exactly, I would say, a communist, but, you know, that called Domenico Lo Sordo, teaches at Urbino, or he's emeritus there at University of Urbino, and he wrote a book called The Black Legend, and he starts with Khrushchev's so-called secret, what is it called? Secret, I can't remember what the official name is. His report, secret report to the Communist Party in 1956. Now, that report was, according to sources, lifted by the Mossad or, you know, Israel and handed to the State Department. Later on, Khrushchev backtracked somewhat. But let's see who Khrushchev was and what his interests were. Now, out of the 1917 revolution, two classes emerged. The workers, who actually led the Petrograd uprising and took over the Winter Palace from the provisional government, and they were proletarians, workers, very small percentage in Russia, 5%. The other group that benefited from the revolution were the peasants, 80% of the Russian population. Now, within the peasants, as I mentioned, you know, as I mentioned before about my family, there is a tendency to improve your situation. In other words, there is a petty bourgeois ideology. These two, therefore, proletarian industrial workers, were actually classes. And Bukharin, who at first was led the left communist and moved theoretically from radical left to radical right, was really a proponent of what we can call social democracy, gradualism, nothing that will hurt the peasants. You see? Yeah. And out of that Bukharin branch of peasant-centered, it would become, you know, economic policies, came the Khrushchev line. Whereas Stalin had said, let's have socialism in one country and subject the country to the need for industrialization, that is, agriculture, to feed the cities, etc., Khrushchev was of the opposite, and he, in fact, shifted the economy of Russia from militarism, essentially, for emphasis on the military economy, to the agrarian economy, privileging the peasants. So this comes right straight out of Bukharin 1917. Now, what happens with Khrushchev? He opened the Communist Party to indiscriminate membership, which it you know, you could call it elite under Stalin, but a really severe kind of education was required to become a member of the Communist Party, and instead, Khrushchev opened it up. There were oppositions, which are never mentioned in the West, to Khrushchev, and they were squelched. You know, Malenkov's minority in the party tried to stop him from shifting to agrarian emphasis. Now, why was this? Why do I bring this up? Because this privileging of the agrarian faction actually led to this diminishing of revolutionary fervor, and what am I saying? And and the rise of a second economy. That is okay. We have small entrepreneurs; they are encouraged by Khrushchev, etc. This second economy became extremely corrupt. So, and this is, you know, a long story, and I'm getting.
It's okay.
You know, over the, yeah. but essentially what won in 1956 and thereafter is a reformist practice. In fact, Khrushchev said to Kennedy, "Hey, we voted for you." You know, and jokingly in meeting, mm-hmm. but that's what happened. It's that they lost the idea of the. That the Cold War that the United States was serious about and would continue to undermine the Soviet Union, etc. So I think that the reformist party, and it's a good question for us, you know, kind of led to being silent about the second economy, about encouraging it, and then theft from the state, you know, buying party members to be able to conduct some underhanded enterprise, etc. And this is the class that came out. And so what you had, even within the Soviet Union, was a class struggle between the peasantry and the proletariat in the beginning. And then, you know, everything got kind of, And then, Russian society, or rather Soviet society, at least in the European part, turned, in the practice of conducting business, they assumed business values. Mm-hmm. And this made the turn to capitalism, you know.
What
this is what the force is behind the fall of the Soviet Union. Go ahead, sorry.
No, it's okay. To bring it a little bit closer to home and closer to today, do you see any parallels with this period that you're talking about in the late 50s, 60s in the Soviet Union and the second economy? What brought to mind while you were speaking that to me is Cuba and the rapprochement with the United States, and is Cuba falling into the same trap right now?
You know, that is always the question. Now, that is always a question for us, right? Oh my God, opening, of course. The embargo stays on,
mm-hmm, right,
in Cuba. But you're very good to ask the question, because is it a possibility? Well, let me give a little historical background, mm-hmm, about the sort of thing that Cuba did in the 90s when it allowed a kind of second economy.
Yes.
To prevent starvation, and people in Cuba were starving when the Soviet Union fell apart, and the aid, and you know, the agricultural in Cuba based on chemical manure and that stuff, that Russia was exporting, plus the parts, and I mean, they were starving. So Fidel authorized the, what is it called? What is that? The second economy to, you know, one economy for Cubans, another for visitors, etc. Uh-huh. What is it called? The special period, I think.
Yeah, special period, uh-huh.
Yeah, and he was perfectly aware that it was a step back in the revolution. Same thing happened to Lenin when, after the Civil War, and, you know, the repelling the invasion of the West in the Soviet Union, he initiated the new economic policy, which allowed for foreign investment, private enterprise for the peasants, applying only a tax on their produce, allowing them to sell their surplus on the market, etc. He said, when the Bukharin and Trotsky faction said, this is hideous, this is, you know, betraying the revolution, Lenin said, I know it's a step backward, but I think the party is strong enough to survive it. We need this breathing space. Now, don't forget the Brest-Litovsk peace treaty with Germany took one-fourth of the Russian population away from, you know, the Russian population away from Moscow. One-fourth of their industrial area and nine-tenths of the coal mines. So they were leveled. So the new economic plan was equivalent to this special period in Cuba, and actually equivalent to what China is doing in China now, the mixed economy. Now, Lenin said, but I think the party will be strong enough to survive this setback. That's the question, Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
Is the party strong enough to survive, or is it as weak, or whatever you want to call it, as the Soviet Union's party became after Stalin's death? That's the question.
That is a question. Yeah. I'm fearful that Raul is no Fidel, but, you know, I was in Cuba in 2009, and I had a meeting with Alarcon, who was then...
Yes, I met him too,
President of
please say who he is.
He's the president...
I interrupted you.
President of the... He was then president
he
of
was,
the
yes.
National Assembly in Cuba, revolutionary, I think a really amazing person. But
yes.
He said that they were, you know, when you said, what brought me to mind of this question, Luciana, is you said that Khrushchev told Kennedy that they voted for him, and Alarcon told me the same thing about Obama, basically, is that they voted for him. And it was, you know, it's not... It was not an easing of tensions during the Obama administration under Cuban terms, right? Obama kept on mentioning about all the human rights, so-called human rights violations in Cuba, blah, 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 all the lies. And so it wasn't under Cuban terms, I don't think. And I hope that they're strong enough to survive and of course Trump's rolling all that stuff back anyway. But
So
go ahead.
No, I share absolutely. I mean, it would have frozen me too if somebody in Cuba like Alarcón had said, "Well, we voted for Obama." I don't know what I wouldn't have said anything. But my hope is that this is diplomatic facade.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it makes you pause. How can you say that, you know? How can you say that when Obama continues? It's the blockade, stupid.
Right.
You know, that's how you measure a president's attitude toward policy rather toward Cuba. Will you lift the blockade?
Well, in the last president that the United States had that was a Democrat, before Obama was Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton actually strengthened the blockade against
The Helms, what you call it, Act,
and made it illegal for other countries to trade with Cuba. It's like the nerve of this frickin' country! I swear to God, it frustrates me.
I mean, every morning I get up and say, "This country is really crazy." You know,
it's very diabolical. It's diabolically crazy is what it is.
Perfect description.
To go to some place to get some sane analysis of what's going on, I would recommend people to follow you on Facebook, Luciana Bon.
I have an article come, I think.
Uh-huh.
I submitted an article to Counterpunch on Yemen.
Right.
So.
Oh, I hope that gets posted before Sunday so I can include it, the links, because you do write for Counterpunch. And I was looking you up for this interview, and I saw that some really idiot posted back in 2005, I think, that you were that week's most dangerous professor or something like that.
Oh, I am flattered.
I know. He didn't even put an apostrophe.
I think I was on a list for people who hate America, professors who hate America the most or something like that.
Yes, it was something like that. My daughter went to UC Davis and she had one of those. Keith Wattenpah was in Bill O'Reilly's top 100 most dangerous professors or something like that in the United States. So, well, congratulations for that. That's quite an honor.
Thank you, considering that America educated me to Washington's real policies. That's ironic.
It is very ironic, isn't it? So, Luciana Bon, thank you so much for taking your time to be on the Soapbox this week. I really loved our conversation, and I think my listeners will too.
It was a pleasure to be on and to talk to you, Cindy, whom I admire beyond words.
Oh, thank you. And when I said Luciana, I'm doing the Spanish pronunciation because I live in California.
Yeah, that's good. That's fine. That's where
the Italian pronunciation is so much more.
Thank you again. Thank you very much.
Very
and thank
musical.
You,
Luciana is very musical. So thank you and have a good weekend.
And you too, Cindy. Bye bye.
Bye bye. The Soapbox for this week. I hope you enjoyed the chat that I had with Luciana as much as I enjoyed it. And I hope you learned something. And as always, we're informed and inspired to further action. I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Luciana Bond for being my guest this week. And I'd like to thank you, the Soapbox listener, for listening and supporting our show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.